He came up with a jerk that almost tore Mark's shoulder from its socket. For some animal instinct had kept Mark's grip locked on the pistol hand, and he dangled from that precious hold. The two of them pendulumed over the black emptiness of the shaft, Mark's legs hooked over the rail, hanging at full stretch, with Fergus's body the next link in the chain. Fergus's head was thrown back, staring up at Mark, and with the cap gone, his lank, sandy hair fell back from his face, and Mark felt fresh shock loosen his grip. "Fergus!" he croaked. But the madman's eyes that stared back at him were devoid of recognition. "Try and get a grip," Mark pleaded, swinging Fergus towards the staircase. "Grab the rail." He knew he could not hold many seconds longer. The fall had wrenched and weakened his arm, and the blood was rushing to his head in this inverted position. He could feel his face swelling and suffusing, and the pounding ache in his temples, while the black and hungry mouth of the shaft sickened him. With his other hand, he groped and got a second hold on Fergus's wrist. Fergus twisted in his grip, but instead of going for the rail, he reached upwards and took the pistol from his own hand, transferring it to his free hand. "No!" Mark shouted at him. "Fergus, it's me, Mark!" But Fergus was far past all reason as he juggled with the Webley, getting a firing grip on the hilt with his left hand. "Kill them," he muttered. "Kill all the scabs." He lifted the barrel to aim upwards at Mark, dangling over the drop, twisting slowly in that double retaining grip. "No, Fergus!" screamed Mark, and the muzzle of the revolver pointed into his face. At that range, it would tear half his head away, and he saw Fergus' forefinger tighten on the trigger, the knuckle whitening under pressure. He opened his hands, and Fergus's wrist slipped from his fingers. He spun away, falling swiftly, and the revolver never fired. But Fergus began to scream a high, thin wail. Still hanging upside down, Mark watched Fergus's body, limbs spread and turning like the spokes of a wheel, as it dropped away, shrinking rapidly in size, and the despairing, wailing cry receding with it, dwindling away to a small, pale speck, like a dust mote, which was swallowed abruptly into the dark mouth of the shaft far below, and the wailing cry with it. In the silence afterwards, Mark hung bat-like, blinking the sweat out of his eyes, and for many seconds unable to find strength to move. Then, from the platform above him, came a long, shuddering moan, and it roused him. Forcing his bruised body to respond, he managed to get a grip on the guardrail and drag himself up, until he tumbled onto the staircase and started up it on rubbery legs. Helena had dragged herself to the pile of timber, leaving a dark, wet smear across the platform. The khaki breeches she wore were sodden with blood, and it oozed from her still to form a spreading puddle in which she sat. She lay back against the timber next to the tripod at Vickers in an attitude of utter weariness, and her eyes were closed. "Helena," Mark called her, and she opened her eyes. "Mark," she whispered, but she did not seem surprised. It was almost as though she expected him. Her face was completely drained of all colour, the lips seemed rimmed with frost, and her skin had an icy sheen to it. "Why did you leave me?" she asked. Hesitantly, he crossed to her. He knelt beside her, looked down at her lower body, and felt the scalding flood of vomit rise in his throat. "I truly loved you." Her voice was so light, breathing soft as the dawn wind in the desert. "And you went away." He put out his hand to touch her legs, to spread them and examine the wound, but he could not bring himself to do it. "You won't go away again, Mark?" she asked, and he could hardly catch the words. "I knew you'd come back to me." I won't go away again," he promised, not recognizing his own voice, and the smile flickered on her icy lips. "Hold me, please, Mark. I don't want to die alone." Awkwardly, he put an arm around her shoulders, and her head lolled sideways against him. "Did you ever love me, Mark? Even a little bit?" "Yes, I loved you," he told her, and the lie came easily. Suddenly there was a hissing spurt of brighter, redder blood from between her thighs as the damaged artery erupted. She stiffened, her eyes flew wide open, and then her body seemed to melt against him, and her head dropped back. Her eyes were still wide open and dark as a midnight sky. As he stared at it, slowly her face changed. It seemed to melt like white candle wax held too close to the flame. It ran and wavered and reformed, and now it was the face of a marble angel, smooth and white and strangely beautiful, the face of a dead boy in a land far away. And the fabric of Mark's mind pulled and tore. He began to scream, but no sound came from his throat. The scream was deep down in his soul, and his face was without expression, his eyes dry of tears. They found him like that an hour later, when the first soldiers climbed cautiously up the iron staircase to the top of the steel tower. He was sitting quietly, holding the woman's dead body in his arms. "Well," said Sean Courtney, "they've hanged Taffy Long." He folded the newspaper with an angry gesture and dropped it onto the paving beside his chair. In the dark, shiny foliage of the loquat tree that spread above them, the little white eyes pinkled and twittered as they probed the blossoms with sharp, busy beaks, and their wings fluttered like moths about the candle. Nobody at the breakfast table spoke. All of them knew how Sean had fought for leniency for those strikers on whom the death sentence had been passed. He had used all his influence and power, but it had not availed against the vindictive and vengeful who wanted full measure of retribution for all the horrors of the revolt. Sean brooded now at the head of the table, hunched in his chair with his beard on his chest, staring out over the Ladyburg Valley. His arm was still supported by the linen sling. It had not healed cleanly, and the bullet wound was still open and draining. The doctors were anxious about it, but Sean had told them, "Leopard and bullet and shrapnel and knife, I've had them all before. Don't twist a gut for me. Old meat heals slowly, but it heals hard." Ruth Courtney, watching him now, was not worried about the wounds of the flesh. It was the wounds of the mind that concerned her. Both the men of her household had come back deeply marked by the lash of guilt and sorrow. She was not sure what had happened during those dark days, for neither man had spoken about it, but the horror of it still stalked even here at Lioncop, even in the bright, soft days, on these lovely, dreaming hills, where she had brought them to heal and rest. This was the special place, the centre and fortress of their lives, where Sean had brought her as his bride. They owned other great houses, but this was home, and she had brought Sean here now after the strife and the turmoil, but the guilt and the horror had come with them. "Madness," muttered Sean, "utter raving madness. How they cannot see it, I do not know." He shook his head and was silent a moment. Then he sighed. "Oh, well, we hang them now and make them live forever. They'll haunt and hound us all our days."
"You tried, dear," said Ruth softly.
"Trying isn't enough," he growled. "In the long run, all that counts is succeeding."
"Oh, Pater, they killed hundreds of people," Storm burst out, shaking her shining head at him with angry colour in her cheeks. "They even tried to kill you."
Mark had not spoken since the meal began, but now he lifted his head and looked at Storm across the table. She checked the other words that sprang to her lips as she saw his expression. He had changed so much since he had come home. It was as though he had aged 100 years. Though there was no new line or mark on his face, yet he seemed to have shed all his youth and taken upon himself the full burden of knowledge and earthly experience. When he looked at her like that, she felt like a child. It was not a feeling she relished. She wanted to pierce this new armour of remoteness that invested him. "They're just common murderers," she said, addressing the words not to her father.
"We are all murderers," Mark answered quietly. And though his face was still remote, the knife clattered against his plate as he put it down. Will you excuse me, please, Mrs. Courtney? He turned to Ruth, and she frowned quickly. Oh, Mark, you've not touched your food. I'm riding into the village this morning. You ate no dinner last night. I want the mail to catch the noon train. He folded his napkin, rose quickly and strode away across the lawn, and Ruth watched the tall, graceful figure with a helpless shrug before turning to Sean. He's wound up so tight like a watch spring about to snap, she said. What's happening to him, Sean? Sean shook his head.
It's something that nobody understands, he explained. We had so much of it in the trenches. It's as though a man can stand just so much pressure, and then something breaks inside him. We called it shell shock, for want of a better name. But it's not just the shelling, he paused. I've never told you about Mark before, about why I picked him, about how and when I first met him.
And he told it to them, sitting in the cool green shade of the loquat tree. He told them of the mud and the fear and the horror of France.
It's not just for a single time or a day or a week, but it goes on for what becomes an eternity. But it is worse for a man who has special talents. We, the generals, have to use them ruthlessly. Mark was one of those.
And he told them how he had used Mark like a hunting dog. And his two women listened intently, all of them bound up in the life of the young man who had gradually come to mean so much to each of them. A man gathers horror and fear like a ship gathers weed. It's below the waterline, you cannot see it, but it is there. Mark carries that burden, and at Fordsburg something happened that brought him close to the breaking point. He is on the very edge of it now.
What can we do for him? Asked Ruth softly, watching his face, happy for him that he had a son at last, for she had long known that that was what Sean saw in Mark. She loved her husband enough not to resent that it was not her own womb that had given him what he so desperately wanted, glad only that he had it at last, and that she could share it with him.
Sean shook his head.
I don't know. And Storm made an angry hissing sound. They both looked at her.
Sean felt that soft warmth spreading through his chest, a feeling of awe that this lovely child could be part of him. Storm looked so smooth and fragile, yet he knew she had the strength of braided whipcord. He knew also that though she had the innocence of a newly opened bloom, yet she could sting like a serpent. She had the brightness and beauty that dazzled, and yet below that were depths that mystified and awed him. And when her moods changed so swiftly, like this unaccountable spurt of anger, he was enchanted by her, under her fairy spell. He frowned heavily now to hide his feelings.
Yes, missy, what is it now? He grumped at her.
He's going away, she said, and Sean blinked at her, swaying back in his chair.
What are you talking about? He demanded.
Mark, he's going away.
How do you know that?
Something deep inside of Sean cringed at the prospect of losing another son.
I know. I just know, she said, and came to her feet with a flash of long, sleek limbs, like a gazelle rising in alarm from its grassy bed. She stood over him.
You didn't think he'd be your lapdog forever? She asked, a biting scorn in her tone that at another time would have brought from him a sharp retort. Now he stared at her speechless. Then suddenly she was gone, crossing the lawn in the sunlight that gilded her loose dark hair with stark white light and struck through the flimsy stuff of her dress, revealing her long slim body in a stark dark silhouette, surrounding her with a shimmering halo of light that made her seem like some lovely, unearthly vision.